Okay, well, every social movement that seeks to seriously transform society, I think, has to understand the role of the state. You know, we need answers to questions like, well, what is the state? Can it be reformed or captured? Is it even relevant anymore? You know, are corporations the main enemy? Do we need to replace it with something, or do we just sort of live in utopia immediately after we get rid of it? And Lenin wrote State and Revolution to kind of deal with all of these questions. And the arguments in this short pamphlet were both a vital intervention into the debates going on in the Russian party at the time, immediately before October, but also a more general critique of reformism in general. And the thing that kind of sparked off this critique and this rethinking about the state was the split in the socialist movement prior to World War One, or at World War One, when the majority, overwhelming majority of socialist parties backed the war. And Lenin sought to reclaim the kind of traditions of Marxism, the internationalist traditions, from these betrayers. And it's no surprise then that in this period, Lenin wrote two of his most important theoretical works, one on imperialism, the national question, and one on the state. And so Lenin's main argument in State and Revolution is pretty simple. It's that the state needs to be totally dismantled, you know, not captured, not transformed, not modified, but destroyed. And those of you who read the pamphlet will notice that he's got a bit of a grudge against someone called Kautsky. And there's a reason for this, because Kautsky was a leading Marxist theoretician at the time. He was often referred to as the Pope, and although, you know, he was actually Lenin's personal and political mentor for decades, as Lars Lee has illustrated in some depth. And so, yet in 1914, despite being the kind of leading theoretician of Marxism, Kautsky didn't really consistently oppose World War One. And so Lenin really had a score to settle. And so he goes back and reads Karl Marx and Engels on the question of the state. And he finds, and particularly their writing on the Paris Commune in 1871. And when he reads them, he finds very clearly that Marx clarified his position in 1871 and 72, that actually the one modification he made to the Communist Manifesto was on the question of the state. And he says, the state needs to be smashed. I was wrong. I was unclear. 1871 has taught us we need to get rid of it. But not only that, that it has to be replaced by a proletarian state, by a worker state. And so Lenin takes up these arguments and elaborates it in some detail about what this state will look like, what it means, how it will work, and how it will eventually actually disappear altogether. And this argument is a response to a different set of people, a syndicalist and anarchist tradition that had kind of grown in the period around, and particularly during World War One. And so these are the two issues I'll be discussing in this talk. First, the argument the state needs to be destroyed, and secondly, that a worker state needs to replace it. Right, but first, a quick background to the period Lenin's writing in and to the issues, because the period before World War One was a boom time for European capitalism, fueled by the colonisation of the Third World. And as a product of this colonisation and development, there was a development of a massive, centralised and powerful state apparatus in the European empire, in the European sort of heartlands. And one of the side effects of this was actually the growth of the working class and the soldiers' organisations, the military in Central Europe, as both commodity production and the war industries grew. And these conditions were a period of boom for the workers' organisations, for the left, as, you know, strengthened by this objective economic situation, our workers saw their power. And so the Social Democratic Party, the Second International, were able to grow really enormously. So, you know, the SPD in Germany had 1 million members by 1914. But this period of slow and steady growth had a real impact on these organisations, particularly on the leadership. They came to see the transition to socialism not as some revolutionary break with the status quo with capitalism, but as a kind of automatic, gradual procedure by which workers would come to power. And Kautsky explains how this will work. You know, democracy offers the possibility of cancelling the political power of the exploiters. And today, with the constant increase, a very mechanical, in the number of workers, this in fact happens more and more frequently. And, you know, I wonder what he would say about the mining tax or any of these kinds of things today. But still, that was the argument, that it was inevitable, that it was going to happen. And those who accepted this kind of view, this fatalistic view of how socialism would occur, denied something at the very heart of Marxist thought, that the state had to be confronted and overthrown by the self-activity of the working class. And Kautsky made this very clear in 1912, where he says, the objective of our political struggle is the conquest of state power, fine, through the conquest of a majority in parliament, not so fine, certainly not the destruction of state power. But usually this was hidden behind weasel words like political revolution, support for a people state, and so on. So Ossietzky acknowledged that the state was currently an agent of capitalist rule, but he believed that it could be transformed. And so the basic argument was the state is a neutral institution that presides above society. It's not shaped by that society, but it's above it, and that it can be wielded by either the capitalists, which is currently the case, or the working class. And so, if accepted, this argument would actually mean revolution is redundant. So it's no surprise that Lenin starts on this kind of philosophical terrain, on the nature of the state itself. And Lenin begins by asserting that the state is an organ of class rule, an organ for the oppression of one class by another. It is a creation of order which legalizes and perpetuates this oppression by moderating the conflict between the classes. Now, there are a few important things I'm missing. Firstly, it's talking about all states, and that's worth remembering, that it's not just about the capital state, it's about all states. And the capital state in particular is the arbiter of capital, and it rules for capital and arbitrates between capital and working class. And it's not just the elections, because people say, oh, you know, we can have elections, we can elect a left-wing majority, surely this is the working class, you know, all of us could get elected, wouldn't that be socialism? Well, the state is not more than, is much more than parliament. It's about the bureaucracy, and it's about, as well, the judiciary, all of which exist primarily to protect private property and enforce the subordination of unions to bosses, for example, and so on. You know, Mikey gave an example earlier, yesterday actually, that 90% of the Australian legal system is dedicated to laws about private property. And there are examples of this, you know, like in 1975, the clear thing, Whitlam, you know, just moderate reforms, not even anti-capitalist by any stretch, just moderate reforms. He was sabotaged by the High Court and by the leader of the Treasury, and he was eventually sacked by an unelected person in the Governor General. But beyond this is understanding that the state is ultimately made up of a special body of armed men and women these days with a monopoly on power within territorial boundaries. Now, this classic definition is important to come back to time and time again, because it's the key thing. It's the most difficult to challenge. And it's a thing which, as long as the bourgeoisie controls the power, military power, force within a territorial boundary, they are in control. And so in revolutions, this is the key question, for example, in Egypt. And there are two reasons for this. Firstly, that generals themselves and the leadership of the military apparatus are more or less part of the ruling class. You know, the military-industrial complexes that have developed make them pretty much you know, definitely part of the ruling class. But it's more than that. It's not just the individuals. It's that force itself determines political outcomes in at certain levels of struggle. And as long as the bourgeoisie retains the monopoly on force, they can survive, they can rebuild. And that's why, in revolution after revolution, actually arming the working class to break that monopoly, but also splitting the army, i.e. splitting the rank and file from the leadership and destroying that institution, is vital. Okay, but you'll notice as well in Lenin's formulation that most of the time, he says, by moderating the conflict, and I think really we have to see that most of the time, this is what the state does, it moderates. And this is a complex task, and this is what leads to confusions, because it's not always best achieved by just denying the workers everything they've ever wanted and by, you know, crushing every activity they put up. There are times where gains can be made against the wishes of the bourgeoisie by parliament, through parliament. Other times, there is some overlap between the interests of workers very temporarily and the capitalists. For example, in the post-war boom in the 1950s and 60s, economics, you know, the economic boom was in place and workers were needed. There was a shortage of workers. So actually, healthcare and you know, all that kind of stuff, education became very important and was momentarily agreed upon. Of course, very quickly, when the economic recession began, the capitalist class withdrew their support for these policies and they were consequently watered down. But the thing to see is that where possible, the capitalists try and rule with an element of workers' consent to the status quo. Rather than enforce it against their will, it's much more stable. And this can lead to confusions, but I think ultimately they're prepared to ditch consent. They're prepared to rule through the brutal iron fist of force. And I think Lenin articulated this, but I think it's worth looking at a small example in Chile, 1973, just to illustrate it, you know, where you had in September the 11th, 1973, a coup by General Pinochet, who came to power on the back of a coup against a socialist leader, a moderate socialist leader, Salvador Allende. And the background to this tragedy was this insurgent workers' movement. They set up cordones, which were like community councils all across the country. They were organizing distribution of resources and so on. And they were pretty much in charge of many areas. They were defending against fascist thugs, some of them were becoming to be armed, and so on. But all this energy was squandered because the left was too busy actually engaging debates within the popular popular unity government, which Allende was a part, about how we can possibly push Allende to the left, and so on. So all these internal debates within the organisation, rather than any emphasis on what was going on the working class in the street. And in the meantime, Allende had ignored all their pressure from within. He'd invited General Pinochet to actually serve in the cabinet, the socialist cabinet, and it wasn't long after that till he was assassinated and the workers' movement was crushed. Now, Lenin predicted this ability of different arms of the state to kind of step in to maintain the bourgeois order at critical times. He said, "It's quite easy to revert from a parliamentary bourgeois republic to our monarchy, for all the machinery of oppression, the army, the police, and the bureaucracy is left intact." And we've seen that elsewhere, such as Germany, the 30s, France, under the Vichy government, and so on. But it's also important the fact that at revolutionary junctures in history, and this is a more timeless lesson as well, the parliamentary republic hampers and stifles the independent political life of the masses, their direct participation in the organisation of the life of the state from the bottom up. And what this means is there are times, not all the time, but there are times when the class struggle gets to a point where it will be decided by force. And so debates about the parliamentary motions being moved and so on can get to be distractions. What is really key is the self-organisation, the self-activity, and ultimately the arming of the working class on the ground that is key. And the left in Chile was not clear on either of these points. And so they made both mistakes. They weakened the workers' movement by channeling all the energy and by distracting themselves in parliamentary manoeuvres, and they left the repressive apparatus of the state intact. And for these mistakes, they were horrendously crushed. So I think Lenin was very right to emphasise that revolution consists not in the new class commanding and governing with the aid of the old state machine, but actually in smashing this machine altogether. And I think it's very clear these issues remain relevant, for example, in the Middle East today. In places like Egypt and Tunisia, the figurehead is gone, but the structures remain intact, and in particular, the military remains intact. And I think for things to go forward, that cannot remain the case. Okay, but Lenin is not just content to theorise the need to kind of abolish the state. He's more practical than that. He says, "The theory of the class struggle leads as a matter of course to the recognition of the political rule of the proletariat, that is, of undivided power directly backed by the armed force of the people. And the overthrow of the bourgeoisie can only be achieved by the proletariat becoming the ruling class." Now, clearly in making this argument, Lenin is confronting another tradition in the workers' movement, that is of syndicalism. And as I said earlier, this whole layer of syndicalists had developed before the war and particularly during the war, embittered by the betrayals of the Socialist Party. Now, this pamphlet, this argument, is an argument to these workers. It is not simply enough to destroy the machine. You have to think about what happens next. And Lenin is quite critical in this way of anarchism. He says, even in its most revolutionary form, it's of no use. And I think we can see this when we read an account by a syndicalist who later became a socialist and then a Trotskyist, who says, "The anarchist position was this: a short general strike and the regime would collapse. And after a few days of agitation, with minimal violence, the syndicalists would peaceably proceed to the building of a new society." Now, Lenin explains the differences between this kind of lovely fantasy and the Marxist approach in one really important paragraph, which I'm just going to quote at length. He says, "The distinction between Marxists and anarchists is this. The former, Marxists, while aiming at the complete abolition of the state," so we agree with the anarchists on that, "recognise that this aim can only be achieved after classes have been abolished by the socialist revolution, as a result of the establishment of socialism, which leads to the withering away of the state. The latter, the anarchists, want to abolish the state completely overnight, not understanding the conditions under which this can happen. The former recognise that after the proletariat has won political power, it must destroy the old apparatus and replace it by a new one, consisting of an organisation of the armed workers. The latter, while insisting on the destruction of the state machine, have a very vague idea of what the proletariat will put in its place." And I think Lenin here is focusing, and rightly so, on one of the key issues that workers will face in the post-revolutionary situation, and that of survival, of defending against both the white terror at home and the international bourgeoisie, which will inevitably support them. And he says, well, the argument here is pretty simple. Without centralised and coordinated political as well as military strategy, the revolution will be over before anyone begins to dream of socialism. And I think it's a refusal of anarchists to see this point, and the outright hostility to a worker state on principle that makes their ideas, while although sounding revolutionary at times and can be genuinely so, potentially reactionary at crucial times in our movement, in our history, and in the future. I mean, this is made clear very obviously in Spanish Revolution in 1936, especially in Catalonia, in Northeast. There, the state machine was in tatters, and workers' councils effectively had de facto control. But when offered official formal control through these councils, the CNT refused. And you might say, well, this is a mistake, but it's principled, right? At least they're consistent adhering to what they stand for. But of course, under the pressure of the situation, of the potential defeat coming up, its leaders joined the capitalist government 1 year later and actually condemned the working class militants into Catalonia who rose up against this government and against the fascists in 1937 and called on them to trust us, trust the government, and to disarm, which is exactly what the Communist Party, which they so hated at the time, was saying as well. And so it's precisely to prevent this kind of flip-flopping, which is what Lenin went to great lengths to explain, the nature of the workers' state, what it would look like, what the transition to communism must look like in the general sense, and how it will all operate. So he begins first by clarifying the difference between a bourgeois and a workers' state. Because the bourgeois state, and you know previous states for that matter, exists to maintain the control of a minority over a majority. And a project, by definition, is going to be undemocratic. It requires force to maintain itself. On the other hand, for our side, extreme force and undemocratic force. So on our side, on the other hand, the worker state exists to maintain the rule of a majority and to impose the wishes of the majority over a tiny group of parasites. And none of us are strong enough to affect this authority on our own. No individual workplace or industry can survive without the rest. And so here, again, scientifically, by definition almost, inclusiveness, democracy and transparency will be key to maintaining the unity and organisation of the revolutionary working class and its allies. And to reinforce this point and to illustrate it, Lenin returns to the Paris Commune in some depth. The first revolution, the workers took power for themselves. And for Lenin, as for Marx and Engels before him, this revolution, this wonderful event, is the first and final proof of why the working class is called the genuinely democratic class and why it's right to do so. Because they abolished the old monarchy, they replaced it with radical democracy, they had recallable delegates at every level, they abolished the police and the army and replaced it instead with an electable militia, you know, so you elected your officers and so on, they could be replaced. The same was true for the judiciary. You know, you didn't have these unelected people making decisions about, you know, how to enforce the law. Actually had democratic legal process whereby things could be changed and people could be replaced if their decisions were not respected. And the best thing about all this was that every single elected position came without privilege or benefit. They were paid for the same wage as the average kind of worker in Paris at the time. Now, unfortunately, the weakness of the Paris Commune was its influence by non-Marxist ideas. Because influenced by Proudhonists and anarchists, the workers of Paris failed to kind of take the initiative and see the importance of fully confronting the old regime. So they took too long, far too long, to try and spread the revolution beyond the walls of Paris. They refused to nationalise the banks, the state bank there, and so on. And I think the reality is, just as it taught the workers' movement the importance and the democratic nature of the working class, it also taught us the importance of strategy, a post-revolutionary strategy. Actually, these mistakes made by the Paris Commune had enormous consequences. Just 1 month after being defeated, 37,000 people would have been killed by the conquering capitalist class. 37,000 people. Okay, but Lenin goes further than this. He says even the wonders of the Paris Commune, the democracy, which is unprecedented, is not the end point. Actually, it's only the first step in the kind of economic and cultural revolution, notwithstanding Maoism, on the way to communism. He explains, to prevent the true meaning of this struggle, of Marx's struggle against anarchism from being distorted, Marx expressly emphasized the revolutionary and transient form, that's in quotes, of the state which the proletariat needs. So it's revolutionary and it's transient. Two important things. Because once the material basis for class divisions in a society are abolished, i.e. once all the parasites become incorporated into the working class, and you know the urban poor are given jobs in the third world and here as well and so on, there is no need for the state, for the special body of armed men and women to defend the working class from some hostile force. And so in this situation, the workers' state will wither away. There'll be no point. It'll have no purpose. And this will be the beginning and really the achievement of communism, a classless and stateless society. Okay, so to sum up, the betrayal of the Socialist Party at the end of World War One led to a huge, you know, debate and polemics within the workers' movement, between Lenin in particular and the Second International. And there are many aspects to this argument, but I think they all pretty much hinge on the socialist attitude to the state. For Kautsky, the development of the state and its institutions in the era of imperialism was to be welcomed. You know, it was a sign that the conditions were ripening, that this wonderful instrument's being fine-tuned so it can be captured and used for the working class. For Lenin, the imperialist state was an abomination. It was a monstrous parasite that sucked more and more and more out of the working class, both locally but obviously internationally, through imperial war. For Kautsky, the imperialist state had to be defended because clearly it was the tool that you would use to bring about socialism. You know, he called it the most powerful instrument. For Lenin, the capitalist state was a mortal enemy of the working class, and so it had to be totally smashed. Now, Lenin's argument here had an enormous impact. In Russia, the pamphlet was key to kind of reorienting and hardening up the Bolshevik Party to support for continuing the revolution right up to October and subsequently. And it provided much-needed clarity against the kind of people like Kamenev and Zinoviev who kind of clung to some of the backwards ideas of the Second International. But internationally as well, the pamphlet had an important impact. Together with the actual experience of the October Revolution, it drew a line in the sand between millions of revolutionaries who had not considered themselves Marxists, understood of the revolution theory and practice of the October Revolution was what they were fighting for. And a quote from Alfred Rosner, the ex-syndicalist I mentioned earlier, kind of tells the story. It's quite beautiful, actually. Some copies of a book by Lenin called State and Revolution had arrived in France early in 1919. Lenin, a Marxist and a social democrat, was treated as an outcast by theoreticians of the socialist parties, which claimed to be Marxist. "It isn't Marxism," they shrieked. "It's a mixture of anarchism and blunkism." On the other hand, for revolutionaries situated outside the mainstream of orthodox Marxism, for the syndicalists and the anarchists, this blunkism was a pleasant revelation. They had never heard such language from the Marxists they knew. And I think the reason for this is the pamphlet's angry denunciations of Kautsky and his bankrupt theories perfectly fit the mood of bitterness and anger following the betrayals of the Second International and the horrors of World War One. And by emphasising their shared hatred of the capitalist state and clarifying the really wonderful democratic nature of the workers' power, Lenin was able to bring the best of these workers and militants under the influence of revolutionary Marxism, which was really the precondition to forming the Third International. But this pamphlet is not just of historical significance. I hope you've seen that, because in his preface to the pamphlet, Lenin writes, "The world proletarian revolution is clearly maturing, and the question of the relation of the socialist proletarian revolution to the state, therefore, is acquiring not only practical political importance, but the significance of the most urgent problem of the day." Well, we too are in an era of revolution, and activists around the world, particularly in the Middle East, are facing this question right now. We've seen how, you know, people in Egypt are beginning to realise the military, you know, sections of the people, are beginning to realise the military is not their ally. But to seriously challenge General Tantawi and his mates, our workers and the poor are going to have to begin building alternative institutions of power. They're going to have to develop a situation of workers' councils or whatever. And they might not be, you know, the classic workers' councils, factory councils. They might be rank-and-file trade union committees. They might be local neighbourhood defence committees. The form is not so important as the content. But they are organs of the revolutionary working class and the oppressed. But they are schools of revolution where workers can experience struggle and learn through it, and that they can be the embryo of a future socialist society. And now obviously the situation in the West is nowhere near as advanced as this, but I think the struggles against austerity taking place in Europe and America are being confronted with governments both left and right, you know, slashing social spending and so on, and deploying tens of thousands of police to crush anyone who dares to resist. And I think in this context then, understanding the nature of the state, what to do about it, and what to replace it with has never been more important as it is in 2011.